Welcome to this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I'm the chair of the Humanities Forum, which organized today's event. We also welcome our listening audience, both on the radio and online, and we invite everyone to visit us at www.commonwealthclub.org. Tonight, it's my pleasure to introduce the speaker, who's George Hammond. The radio and online audience don't understand that joke. I'll be speaking today. I speak once a year usually, and tonight's my opportunity. And what I'm going to talk about are the patterns in our personalities. I think the main way to get a better idea of why I come at this subject the way I do is that I'm one of 12 children. And when I was 10 years old, I was helping my oldest brother, you know, babysit. We were cleaning up after dinner. I was putting the dishes away in the pantry, and suddenly a large volume of water came pouring through the ceiling of the pantry. And so I called my brother and Gene, what's going on? He said, I don't know, but get upstairs and find out. So I ran up the back stairs and got to the hall. And in the hall, we had a big old house, and there was a hallway running all the way down, and the carpet was soaked right outside of the bathroom. So I went and opened up the bathroom door, and a lot of water came pouring out. It must have been 3-4 inches of water in the bathroom. And inside the bathroom were three of my younger brothers, 5, 3.5, and 1.5 years old. And I said, what are you guys doing? He says, we're making a swimming pool. And they had plugged up the toilet, not the toilet, they plugged up the sink, and they plugged up the bathtub, and they were overflowing continuously. And just as I got that information, and my older brother at 15 came running into the room. He said, what's going on in here? And the 5-year-old and the 3.5-year-old both pointed at the 1.5-year-old and said, he did it. And my brother, who was very angry at the time, picked up the plunger and whacked the 1.5-year-old on the butt. And as he was doing that, the 5-year-old and the 3.5-year-old went running out the door, down the back stairs and out, and disappeared for a couple of hours. And of course, my brother realized right after he whacked the 1.5-year-old on the diaper that he might not have been responsible. And this taught me right from the age of 10 that, authority is not always correct in its judgment. and that the actors in most things lie about what they've been doing. In addition to that, over the years, my brothers and sisters are quite intelligent in general, and I got obviously a very, very good and thorough experience of seeing large numbers of points of view being very different and yet having substance to them that is somewhat compelling, somewhat persuasive, but nobody had a totally persuasive point of view. So a couple of years later, when I was around 14, I was reading The Republic by Plato. And I was very entranced by one of the ideas. And the idea was, if you get your first principles straight, everything else falls into place. So I kind of used that a lot, and I won't tell you what I used it for in the next couple of years, because that will take a couple hours. But I put it aside for a little while when I was around 18. I got involved in Indian philosophy and meditation, and I taught that for a while, and I studied it. And then I went back to it, maybe 21, started using Plato's arguments, Plato's reasons against the ideas that I had been teaching to try to clarify some questions that I had about it. Instead, I broke it apart. And I found that very fascinating. I also found it fascinating that I was confident that I had broken it apart properly, that I had a very good argument. So I started delving into something from a different point of view. Let me tell you some of the patterns that I saw to get started, and then I'll get to the personality patterns that I saw. The first thing I thought was, it was the late 60s, early 70s. Lots of people were doing this, but, we were trying to find out what was common to all religions, what was common to all philosophies, what it is that we all had in common, the whole thing, because there certainly has got to be, a lot of you, not the younger ones here, but those of you who are over 60, heard, this analogy of the elephant 100 times, Somebody's got the tail of the elephant, someone's got the trunk of the elephant, there are 5 blind men walking around an elephant, it's an old, and someone's got the leg, and everybody's describing a part of the truth, but of course no one has the whole truth, and that was the analogy that was used. And I thought that was a pretty good analogy until I thought more deeply about it and realized that that's probably not accurate. That's just a way of explaining that there's a lot of differences between the way we argue. So I looked at it a little bit more thoroughly. So why is it that people approach these subjects the way they do? What is it that they've done? And I saw a pattern that I found fascinating. If you just take the human personality as a bell curve, you know, so you distribute the human personality over a bell curve like this, and this is the average human personality. It's right in the big middle of that big bell curve. Most everybody's familiar with the bell curve, so I don't have to. Okay, great. So right in the big middle of that bell curve, that's the average human personality. And way down on the far end are the sociopaths and the psychopaths, and so on. You know, there are not too many people like that, but we've got a few, and they're way out there. And their attitude is very interesting, but I'll first describe the other end. So at the other end, you might have all the major leaders of thought in the human race, all the religious leaders, all the philosophers, all the scientists. They're all out at the other small end in terms of thought. Not that they're better at everything, but just I distributed them that way, and I said, what's fascinating about this pattern is very simple. If you look at the sociopaths and the psychopaths and ask them what their opinion of the human race is, what do they say? They say, they don't understand life at all. Life is a dog-eat-dog world. There is no goodness. There is no justice. There is no beauty. Just take what you can get and grab it all and move forward. That's what they say. And they think everybody's a dupe. You know, a little bit like P.T. Barnum said. You know, there's a mark made every minute, you know, at a circus. So that's their opinion about humanity. Now, if you ask somebody right smack in the middle of the average personality, and I won't use Dubuque, Iowa like everybody else does, but you know what I mean. You take somebody there and you say, you know, what do you think of humanity? And a person with an average personality would say, you know, people have their good spots, they have their bad spots, but they're pretty good and I kind of like them. It's very nice, I'm comfortable here. They have a generally genial attitude towards humanity, except for during wars or big problems. Now you go out to the end over here, all the religious leaders, all the top scientists, all the philosophers. What is their opinion of humanity? They don't know what they're doing. They need a 10-step program, if not a 20-step program. They need you know, just to be able to get up in the morning and brush their teeth correctly. Their opinion is that we're in terrible need of reformation. And when I realized that the high end had a very bad opinion of the middle, then I thought, you know, that's because that's where they are, and they're looking in this direction. And I had been studying Plato for a long time, even though I was in my early 20s. I mean, I've been really going through his ideas for a while, and I realized that this was his mistake. This was Plato's error. Plato was sitting, I think it's not too hard to say Plato was one of those guys on that end of the spectrum, and nobody can understand him, so he must be. So he's sitting out here at this end of the spectrum, and what was he doing with the Republic and all of his ideas? He was trying to define virtue and truth and beauty and come to a conclusion about all these things, and he created a Republic that only he could live in. He created something that even maybe he couldn't live in. He aspired for something out in the future. So basically, he was saying, this is the world I would be comfortable in if everybody was like this. And he wasn't nearly as restricted as some people, you know, tell him, say how restrictive he was. He was conservative, but he was not as bad as people, you know, say how draconian he'd be or fascist or anything like that. He just liked order, you know, and he liked people to pursue their happiness in a particular way. You know, I mean, anybody that says heaven is a place where everyone discusses philosophy all the time, you know there's a problem. That humanity is not really going to go for that approach. I mean, there's a billion people who believe that it's, you know, where you get 70 virgins when you die. But there's only about 10 that believe that you go there and discuss philosophy. So Plato, you know, was not talking about all of us. He was talking about this far end, and he was moving out. And I thought, you know, this is his error in trying to define things. He was always defining the absolute high end of what was going on. And so I said, well, you know, let's get the right approach. Get first principles straight. Everything else will fall into place. But you need to look at what's common to everything and not worry about the high end. You've got to explain the psychopaths, too. You've got to explain everything. You even have to explain the animals. You have to explain all minds. You have to explain what's going on in this world. And to do that, you have to take what's in common. And I thought one of the things that I also thought was, you know, reason is still at the beginning of our use of reason. You know, humanity is still babies when it comes to using reason. I know that we've had a nice technological revolution recently, but it's only been a couple of hundred years since we got reason back again. people have always used reason, you know, and when they figure out how to lie to others, which is probably, you know, 50 million years old, they always reason their way through how to lie to other people. And so it's not that reason was invented 2,500 years ago by Pythagoras or some of the early, you know, pre-Socratic philosopher. It's just that they began to apply it to something that wasn't, you know, how to lie to your neighbor, but, you know, how to figure out what was going on. And one of the interesting things about that was that, you know, it was partially due to the fact that they could start to read other people's opinions. Before that time, there were lots of religious explanations about life. And almost every single one of them is just like today. It's the only truth. That was always a very important part of any religious explanation, because that's its emotional value to the people who believe in it, that they have the truth and other people don't. That's one of the emotional strong values it has. But the philosophers probably read, you know, were created. There's some in ancient India from maybe 1,000 years earlier. They read all the different competing things and heard them all say, we're the only ones who have it, and saw how they disagreed with each other. And therefore, they realized, well, maybe everybody can't be right about the fact that they have the only truth. And so maybe nobody does, or maybe everybody does, or maybe there's something in common. And they began to think about how to discriminate between these. And I think the use of reason was born in that environment. Now, reason triumphed for, not triumphed, but it was at least in use for a couple of hundred years after Socrates and Plato. The Romans used it a lot. There was a lot of technological advances. There was a lot of mathematical advances, Euclid, Archimedes. Lots of scientific things were going on, relatively speaking. And then it went out of fashion. It went out of fashion for maybe 1,500 years. Obviously, everybody kept using reason, but they did not apply it to, you know, the big questions of life. And when it came back in again, maybe 300-400 years ago, it was mostly applied to technology. Mostly, not only, but mostly it's been applied to technology. And that's why I say we're still babies at using reason. We really don't use it properly, and not we use it properly, but we don't use it for all the important things in life. Technology is very valuable. I'm not saying that, but the 20th century's big error in science, I think, among scientists is due to their fear of touching all these other subjects that are quite abstract and so on. But because they're afraid of those subjects, they concluded, because it was so successful, that we can only know what we can measure. And so the 20th century has really been a great measurement 100 years for humanity. And because of all the great measurements we've done, we've got great technology. Our technology is going to go through the roof in the next 100 years, I'm sure. And we probably won't even recognize lots of things if we were around to see it. But that's not really what's crucial to our human life. You know, tools can get better and better and better. And certainly, if you've got better tools, your army's going to win. That's the most important thing driving it. But other than that, you know, you can only go so far. You know, 3 televisions is maybe enough per home. You know, and so although it's fine to have more, I don't have any objection to it or anything like that, but it's not going to add greatly to the sum of human happiness compared to understanding what we're doing now. So that's the background I was looking at. And then I thought to myself, well, why is it that people don't touch this? Well, first, one of the things I thought of was the guys who first came out, like Plato and Pythagoras, two of my favorite thinkers. You know, when you've been involved in mysticism all along and you're starting to go into reason, it's a little like becoming the first amphibian. You know, you live in the water, and then you get out on dry land, you're still going to be soaking wet. And so they look a little bit mystical to us, but it's because they're coming out of dry land, and they're mystical about what? About eternal ideas. What are the eternal ideas of Plato? They're just concepts. But of course, we've been living with Plato's ideas for 2,500 years, and now we're used to the idea of a concept. And what's a concept? A concept is merely the relationship between things, the patterns between things that we recognize is always accurate. Something like gravity. Now, I don't think, actually, this is an aside, I don't think actually we describe gravity accurately yet. I don't think we've had enough time. It probably is just acceleration. But in any case, we see a pattern. We put a name to it. We're getting close on a lot of big concepts of what the patterns are in the physical world. But we haven't really started with the patterns in the emotional world. Now, why? Why? Because our emotional needs get in the way. Our emotional needs get in the way. Now, why do the emotional needs get in the way of thinking clearly? Because our pursuit of happiness is more important than anything else. And the trick is to thinking clearly is to make it an emotional need. You make thinking clearly one of your emotional needs, and then you can do something with it. That was one thing that I noticed. And that's one of the things, like, for example, Plato or the philosophers, wanting to think clearly was an emotional need of theirs, which is why they drove forward with it. It's only because of the pleasure of discovery in an idea, the clarity of an idea. I mean, Pythagoras was all excited to find out that numbers were a way to have a pattern in things, that you could actually prove things with patterns. It was a very exciting thing. We take it for granted. But, you know, it's a very exciting thing to discover. In music, he found the patterns in music. And that's why we have octaves. That's why we have Western music different than other music. It's because of those mathematical patterns he found. We like the Parthenon and the other classical buildings because they all use harmonious sets of numbers and patterns and numbers that Pythagoras laid out hundreds of years before that became popular. So there was something that got projected into society in terms of order and beauty and harmony. But again, since that time, very few people have really ventured into trying to explain what's going on with our personalities. And as I said, I think the error at that time and the reason that it's been so confusing to people is because he was talking about a high end out ahead of him. It's hard to understand him, much less where he's headed. And this is another pattern that I think in our personalities. We are often concerned with how badly we are doing. We think we could be so much better than we are. Why? We have imagination. If we could not imagine where we can go, then we would be satisfied with what we are. And no matter how good you get, you could imagine a goddess that lives 5 billion years and is in charge of this whole galaxy, and that's her new job, you know, and she's got it for the next billion years, and she could be either very happy with the job and very excited that she's been promoted to this position, or she could say, you know, I could have done a lot better. I could have had 3 galaxies put under my charge. So this attitude towards life actually could be had at any point along the way. And that's why I think that's one pattern I'd like to talk about, because even the psychopaths, I think, can get comfortable being who they are. I think actually they are comfortable being who they are. It's other people who aren't comfortable being who they are, who are much better, who can see a little bit further. Unfortunately, these guys are very comfortable being who they are. And, you know, I don't have any real objection to that either, but I think we have to have laws, you know, to protect ourselves against them. But that's just a social thing. It would be nice if everybody was that comfortable with who they were, but slightly more socially oriented. And I think the best thing for humanity would be if the people at the far end got comfortable with where they are. Why are those people? Because, you know, there's absolutely no support for being a high-end thinker. Absolutely no social support. Your teachers don't like you because you know the answers. You're always raising, it's being Hermione Granger, actually, from Harry Potter, for those of you who know the character. You know, you're always giving the answer. You know the answers that the teachers don't know. This is not a way to be popular. And therefore, a lot of people with this kind of approach to things end up quirky. I mean, we all end up quirky to some extent, but these people get a little bit more quirky than others because they've got to deal with the fact that there's almost no emotional support for their decision. Now, this is true for almost every person to some degree. You know, everyone says, well, that person, you know, that kind of group, they get emotional support for being who they are, but, you know, there's a lot of people telling them that they're not really good the way they are either. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. This is one of the other patterns in our personality that I throw out. I wasn't going to throw out here, but I'll do it now anyway. We all try to project an image of our personalities to other people, don't we? We all want other people to think a certain thing about ourselves. It's never the accurate picture. And let me just mention dating in passing as an example where it's really, really an extreme example of this. But even at work, even, you know, with people we meet, we try to project something that isn't actually accurate. And one of the great ironies of this is, why do we do this? We do this so that people will reinforce that imaginary opinion of ourselves, which is a little bit out. That's our imagination telling us where we could be, as I said before. We want to reinforce that so that we become that. And in trying to reinforce that, we're asking a whole bunch of other people to tell us, yes, that's who you are over there. You're not really, you know, you're that person over there that you're trying to tell me that's better. A few people try to prove that, you know, try to give you the impression they're worse than they are, naughtier than they are. Well, there's a reason for that too, but there's not that many people that do that. Most people try to make yourself feel a little bit better than you are. But in any case, the irony of that whole situation is that what happens if anybody ever believes you when you do that? you immediately discount their ability to perceive. Because you know that that was a lie. And so we spend a tremendous amount of energy trying to convince people, and the only thing that we get from it is when anybody's convinced, we realize that they're not very smart. Well, I would suggest that maybe we should spend some time doing some other things. But that it's one of the one of the patterns that we have. And actually, this is another aside, but this is one of the reasons for our financial distress today. Because a lot of people want to be thought of as much richer than they actually are. So what do? They borrow a lot more money and they live higher than they actually can because they want to give the impression to everybody that they are more than they are. And the government wants to give everybody the impression they has more money than it has. And it wants to tell all the people that are working for it that the pensions are going to be wonderful so that it can get people to work for less money. And eventually, fortunately in these big institutions, it takes 80 to 100 years sometimes before the scheme doesn't work anymore. But there's a reason, there's a psychological reason why this is repeated all the time. There's not like a law of history or anything like that. It's our attempt to project something better than we actually are as our reality. So let's talk about the reality for a little while. So what were the patterns that I eventually saw? So, well, first of all, let's divide up our personalities a little bit. I'm not too fond of making so many Aristotelian categories, but these are pretty big categories, and that is, we have emotions, we have desires, and we have attitudes. So let me just divide our personality into those three for the moment. And your emotions are your, now by the way, I use a lot of ideas, concepts that are very common. Some of them are very similar to what most people think, some are very unusual patterns. But in order to come to clarify the definition of something, you sometimes have to cut off a little bit of what people use it for, in order to find out what's behind the sort of vague idea that people have to get it to be perfectly clear. So that's just a starter for the definitions that I have. But when it comes to emotions, the emotions are totally passive mental activities. We really can't do anything about them. They are passive. It's our emotional reaction. Our emotions are reactions to what we experience. Now, our desires are our active mental decisions made in the pursuit of happiness. That's what we want. We're trying to not necessarily gain happiness, but that's what we do, thinking that we're going to get happiness if we pursue this. And our attitudes are our real understandings, beliefs about life, gained from experience over time. I'll go into that a little bit later. But, people may believe in a religion, they may believe in this, but in the same religion, there are pessimists and there are optimists and there are, and that's your real, those are your real attitudes, those are your real beliefs about life. You may profess every Sunday that Jesus saved you from sin, but if you're a total pessimist and you think everything is rotten, that's really what you believe about life. That only lousy things are going to happen to you and that everything is going wrong. That's what that's your fundamental attitude that experience has taught you. So that's what I mean by attitude. It's not an intellectual belief. It is your real reaction towards things based on the buildup of experience over time. And one of the things when you see the patterns that I lay out is that our experiences are not very good teachers. And why is that? One of the basic reasons has to do with our desires. Our desires, we pursue our desires to gain happiness. When we fulfill them, we gain happiness. When we don't fulfill them, we gain unhappiness. Okay? But what the problem with it is, the confusion of it is, first, there are some things that don't add up correctly in a different way because of our big intellectual beliefs about life, the attempt to explain things has got 80% positive and 20% ideas that throw us off. That's my analysis. But the basic idea of why this doesn't work is because we don't recognize that our motives for doing our desires, the motives we have for our desires, are our real desires. That's what we're really after. I'll give you an example. Say you're watching the Super Bowl, and there's a very clever commercial that tells you that the BMW is the absolute best car in the world, and if you're anybody who's anybody, you'd better go get one. Right? Now, you may realize by now that they actually have a financial reason for telling you that. But if you didn't realize that, I just clued you in. But when you go to buy that BMW, are you only buying it because the ad told you to? No. You're going it because they told you in the ad it's a very safe car, very well-engineered car, and so on. That's not the only reason. Some ads are so obvious now that they say your neighbors will all be jealous of you. Okay. Now I'm going to do a little aside here. It's amazing how many people put up with partners in their life only because they think everybody else is jealous of them for having that partner, in spite of the fact they can't stand being with that partner. There are a lot of movie stars married to people like this. But it's not just movie stars. There's a lot of people, if you want to, is it more, if you ask men, is it more important for you to walk down the street with your partner and have everybody look at all the other men look at you and be jealous that you have that partner? I won't go into any more detail. That's your partner. Or do you want to have someone that you have a lot of fun at breakfast with? I'd say it's at least 50-50. So, and this leads me to another side of the same basic topic. Confidence. I'll talk about confidence a little bit. Trust is one of the emotions that I talk about. There, I see a pattern that there are 11 primary emotions, and I'll talk about them. But trust, I define as the emotion caused by your perception of virtue. Virtue, in this sense, is kind of the old vague, bigger, you know, more pagan word of strength. You see something that's strong, something that's vital. You begin to trust it. For example, if you think that someone's good at basketball, you trust them to be on your team. If you think that someone is a good bank robber because they've done a lot of it, you're going to trust them to do that. It's not just a moral trust. It's a trust in strength. If you take the Russians who are mad about the fact that they've lost power and they love to think about Stalin and wish they had Stalin back, they don't like him and don't trust him to lead their country because he's a nice guy. They like him because he's a hard hand and he will slap their people into, you know, the way that things should be. That's a very harsh analysis, but they trusted Stalin to do that. Enough people trusted him, and he certainly performed on their trust. That's a different kind of trust. So trust is not necessarily, I trust that person to keep my secrets. No, a good example of this is very simple. In the first Bush administration, I mean George W. Bush, from 2000 to 2004, which member of the cabinet was most trusted by the people in America? Colin Powell, exactly. 64% rating, something like that. Next one was like 42. It was like way over everybody else. Colin Powell is general. He's also a politician. He doesn't always tell the truth, but he had everybody else beat by a mile, and so everybody could feel that about him. And every once in a while you could see him actually telling the truth in a press conference, and it makes people, you know, say, hey, he's a little different. So which member of that administration was not trusted by the administration? Colin Powell. And why? Because they didn't have any leverage over him. You trust your inner circle because you have leverage over them to keep your secrets. They believed he had just enough principle that he might spill the secrets if they told him. And so that's my example of trust. Now, confidence is a very good one specific form of trust. It's do you perceive yourself as virtuous or not? Do you have confidence in yourself? Do you perceive yourself as strong? Do you perceive yourself as virtuous? If you perceive yourself as virtuous, you have confidence. If you don't, you don't. Okay. Now, this is also on all different subjects. You can be very confident that you can, row a boat very faster than somebody else, or be very confident that you can play basketball better than somebody else. But you have no confidence whatsoever that if you ask a girl out on a date, she'll say yes. No, all at the same time. So confidence is your perception about each particular thing, and an overall confident person has got it on some basic things, but not on everything. So what's interesting about this is there's a saying, hell hath no fury like a woman scorned, right? Okay, why is that an accurate statement? And why is it women instead of men? You know, hell hath no fury like a man scorned. Doesn't go anywhere. Nobody buys it. Why? Right? It has to do with confidence. Right? Women are confident that if they say to a man, you want to do something, they'll say yes. Because men almost always say yes. And therefore, women's experience, they've done studies, I don't know if you've seen those psychological studies, but they've sent women onto college campuses. Of course, it's college campuses. You know, I'm sure the differences would be when you were 30 years old. But on a college campus, they've sent women, you know, average-looking woman, doesn't have to be spectacular, walk up to college male students and say, would you like to sleep with me? 80% say yes, not knowing her. Now, if you send a man onto college campus, average looking, and have him walk up to random co-eds and ask the same question, it's virtually zero say yes. Virtually zero say yes. And so women have a very different experience than men, and they are very confident that they are desirable. And the men don't have that confidence. Maybe Mick Jagger does. I don't know. You know? So maybe in the future it will be hell hath no fury like a Mick Jagger scorned. Because, you know, maybe Mick Jagger has never been said no to, or once or twice. And I'll bet if somebody said no to Mick Jagger, he would be just as furious as a lot of women are in the circumstances. And I use that example because it has got nothing to do with genes or the X or Y chromosome. It has nothing to do with sex. You know, the females, it has to do with experience. It has to do with why you should be confident or not confident about this subject in particular. So let's go back to the emotions. So I see a pattern where there are 11 primary emotions. And there would be 12 if one of them had, if we had a different word in the language for two different types of this. But the 11 emotions that I see are happiness and unhappiness, passion and fear, trust and distrust, love and hatred, patience and anger, and surprise. Surprise is the one, you know, we don't have a difference between good surprises and bad surprises. And if we had, then there would be 12. But we just say surprise. Now, my definitions for all of these are simple, and I have a handout, so you don't have to try to remember this. Happiness is the definition caused by the fulfillment of a desire, any desire. I'll talk about it a little bit later. Unhappiness is the emotion caused by the non-fulfillment of a desire. They aren't opposites. You can have them at exactly the same time with the same experience if you've got conflicting motives for the same thing and you get what you want, but you have conflicting motives about it. Part of your fulfillment and part of it is unfulfilled. I'll give you, go back to the example about the BMW. So you go and buy that BMW. You're driving it home, and on your way home, you pass your neighbor's yard and you roll down the window very casually and yell out, "So how you doing today, Tom?" You know, as if it has nothing to do with the car you're driving. And Tom says, "Oh, just fine. I see you have a new car. Oh, that's too bad you bought a BMW. Mercedes are much better." And then you look and you see he's got a fairly new Mercedes in his driveway. And what does that do to your pleasure? What does that do to you? The reason it ruins your pleasure, at least part of your pleasure, is because you wanted Tom to be jealous of you and he just made you feel bad instead. So although you got what you wanted, part of what you wanted, which was the jealousy of that particular neighbor, you did not get. Now, as you go by the next neighbor, you try it again, and it works, and then you're happier. But you still have the unhappiness from Tom because he didn't buy what you did, which gives you an insight into how to stop people from getting certain things from you, which is to frustrate their desire. If they're trying to make you afraid of something, just don't be afraid, and they will go practice their goals on other people. But I can't talk too much about that because I'm going to go back to the emotions. So. Unhappiness and happiness, I just defined. Passion and fear. Passion is the emotion caused by the anticipation of happiness. Fear is the emotion caused by the anticipation of unhappiness. Love is the emotion caused by our attraction to beauty. Beauty has to be defined, but we can talk about that a little later. Hatred is our emotion caused by our repulsion from ugliness. Patience is the emotion caused by our acceptance of reality. Anger is the emotion caused by our rejection of reality. And surprise is the emotion caused by an unanticipated experience. Okay? We'll talk about that a little later. But the interesting thing about it, we can't do anything about those emotions directly. And I've got a handout I'll hand out in just a couple of minutes, and I have all those definitions on it. But thing that we can do is that one of the other patterns I saw was that the quality of those emotions varies all over the map. When I tried to define it, as I said, I tried to, you know, that definition will work for a bird trying to eat a worm. The bird trying to eat the worm, when he doesn't get the worm, he's frustrated, he's unhappy. When he gets the worm, he's happy. His emotional reaction is happy. Now, it's not the kind of happiness we want. Or we could, you know, say, you know, eating a Dorito is a desire of ours, and you could just eat one Dorito after another all day long, and you would be happy continuously. And this might be a program for being happy all the time, but the quality of that happiness is not fundamental enough. And it's the difference in the quality. And I, because there's not very much time to discuss an entire new theory of psychology in 1 hour, I thought that I would give you an analogy of what I mean or an example of what I mean by quality. We all hear laughter all the time. And we all know what cruel laughter is, right? When you hear a certain kind of laugh, that's pleasure, but it's also cruel. And that has a very different, the cackling of a witch, for example, is the way that people, you know, will put it. There is a pleasure going on there, or a person who has just done a very destructive deed and really thoroughly enjoys it, you feel a different quality than you do with something lighthearted or with the children playing lightheartedly in the background and laughing and giggling. And everybody loves to hear the children playing lightheartedly because children are usually some of the last people who are 100% in favor of their desires at the time that they're pursuing them. Because you learn to have lots of different motives and lots of different things going on. It gets complex as life goes on. A lot of children, when they're just out to have fun, that's all they want, and that's pure pleasure. And I'm afraid that that's what I think is one of the purest pleasures there is when you're in 100% agreement with yourself about what you desire. So now, the quality of desires. Now, when we go to quality of desire, of course, a lot of people will say, well, you know, there's morals, there's ethics to guide us in all these desires. But I found that was, this is aside from part of the overall theory from which this personality theory comes from. But in that overall theory, I saw that justice, our idea of justice, was not an accurate conception. It was really basically our desire to move other people to our wills. We give rewards and punishments out to bend people to our wills. And that any mind that could be more intelligent than that and realize that if there is free will, there is absolutely no benefit to them in bending other people to their will. Bending, you can persuade people, but you know, totally freely, there's no problem with that. But bending people using fear or using any hook that you can get into, more just like advertising, selling things, you can hook into people's bad emotions or weak emotions or fears so that you can sell something to make money. There's all kinds of things that can be done like that. But no mind worth its salt, you know, past a certain point, we'll go any divinity or anything like that, would ever do such a thing. And rewards and punishments really don't work out in any kind of way, not the theory of karma, not the heaven and hell concept, because there's a time sequence. One of my conclusions was that you can send a man to hell, but you cannot make him suffer. And so you can put somebody in a very difficult situation, and they can turn it into a pleasure. And in that case, there's no way to make them go to hell, you know, whether you want to or not. And I'm sure that if I figured it out, people much more intelligent than I am have already figured that one out too. So I don't think rewards and punishments have anything to do with life. And actually, then I began to think, well, then the pattern is probably inherent in the way we live our lives. The patterns are inherent, moment to moment. And when I saw that, I saw another thing, which was, why do we have this idea of justice? The idea of justice is something we project onto our social interactions because there is something inside our own minds where there's a balance. And it's always there. It never changes. And the balance is very simple. The quality of our emotions is directly related to the quality of our desires. And we think it has to be put into some kind of physical reward punishment scheme. And I'll say it again. The quality of our emotions is directly related to the quality of our desires. Now let's talk about the quality of our desires, right? Because it's not a moral or ethical point of view on it. What's the pattern I saw was what's inherent. Not that any one particular behavior is admirable or not admirable. But there's what's inherent, just like these definitions of the emotions. What's common to all? Right? Well, what is desire? If desire are active mental decisions in order to pursue happiness, then the goal is the fulfillment of happiness. So one of the qualities is the desire fulfillable or not? Right? And the second quality that's very important is it independently fulfillable? That is it totally within your own mental control, your own mind's control, or your own control? Is it neutral? That is, it's not within your control, but it's, you know, it's not dependent upon you or anything else. Or is it dependent? Is it dependent upon other minds? Like, there's a big difference, dependent on other minds or other things, like the rules of nature, the laws of nature, and so on and so forth. If you want to fly, your desire to fly can only be fulfilled if you operate within the laws of nature by making an airplane, so technology or something. You're not going to succeed otherwise. So there's dependent desires, there's dependence or independence of the fulfillability of the desire, and then there is it fulfillable or is it not fulfillable. And that gives us six categories, which are independent productive desires? Are they productive? Yeah, that's the one part. And the other part is, are they productive or are they destructive? That's the element that adds quality. So we have independent productive desires. We have dependent productive desires. We have dependent neutral desires. We have dependent destructive desires. We have independent destructive desires. And we have impossible desires. Other than you know, the impossible dream of Don Quixote, impossible desires are exactly that. You just never fulfill them. And therefore, they are just not worth pursuing. It's just ultimately and only frustrating. Now, it can be that it's improbably fulfillable, like, you know, coming up with a new explanation of life. But that's not logically impossible. There are logically impossible things. That's what I mean by an impossible desire. One of the things that's important about this is that when you see those different qualities, if you see that some desires are dependent upon other people, then you should think contingently. Contingent desiring. I'll give you a good example. Between two different desires, you know, I desire to love so-and-so, and I desire that that person loves me. Right? Because the desire to love the other person is totally within your control. It's an independent, productive desire. And if you have enough of those independent, productive desires and fulfill them, you will have a base of happiness for your whole life. And unfortunately, with given the time and everything, there's not enough time to talk about all these things. So I said, but this is really a fundamental idea. Because if you have that, it's like an ocean of happiness underneath the things that you also pursue. Neutral desires. Instead of being moral about a whole bunch of things, most physical desires are absolutely neutral. Everything. All of the negative things that are said about them and everything, it all has to do with what motive you bring to it. Do you bring cruelty to it? Do you bring sadism to it? Do you bring mutual pleasure to it? What do you bring to it? Is it productive? Is it destructive? Is it independently fulfillable? Is it dependent? So contingent desires are very useful for those productive desires. Somebody else is involved. Now, when you think about it, if you say, you know, I want to marry that person or else, well, you know what? If they don't want to marry you and you actually force them to marry you, it's not that much fun. And the only reason you had the desire was for your own happiness. And so all those desires where another free will is involved should be contingently desired. I would like to persuade that person into loving me so that we can have a good time together, that kind of thing. And if they don't go for it, you know, then you say, well, if they don't love me, I would never be happy with them. Every day waking up and seeing that person, even if I were married to them 50 years, if I asked them every morning, well, do you love me yet? They say, no, but this is not a fun way to live 50 years. Not a fun way to live 50 years. So the self-interest of pursuing your own happiness, again, with these patterns, is not a negative, pejorative, anything. This is what we do, whether we say so or not. And as I explained, even those desires that people say, no, happiness is an unworthy desire in life. It's an unworthy goal in life. What you need to do is go for something higher, nirvana, something else. No, heaven. Okay. Who would go to heaven if it wasn't any fun? It is supposed to be some kind of abstract, blissful happiness. Nirvana is supposed to be some kind of abstract, blissful happiness. It's not the same kind. And because we do this all the time, yeah, what we do is happy. That's real happiness. But what that person does, that's not real happiness. It's just what Plato did. It's just what we all do. And that's why we're confused about what happiness is and how it goes. But these conclusions that happiness is not the goal of what we're after is just because we don't recognize that what they're really after is happiness. And I can tell you that if it got around that nirvana was no fun, there'd be very few people trying for it. Right? And now, the interesting thing about that those kind of goals is that it puts all your energy on one particular desire. That's the only goal. That's the goal in life. That's the main thing. Everything else is subsidiary. Everything else must submit to that desire. And as a result of it, it becomes extremely important. And when you think you've reached it, you're absolutely ecstatic for about 10 years or 1 year or a month. And then you begin to have other desires again. And you wonder what it is. And the yogis and the Buddhist monks and everybody that talks about it says, well, you know, there's a dark night of the soul after enlightenment, and that must not be complete enlightenment. And there's a whole bunch of arguments about it. But the basic thing is that you've got that desire, you've fulfilled it, and you know, I was a good Catholic boy raised, and going to communion was nirvana for us. And it's because that was your belief in the actual experience. And when you no longer believe it, when you no longer desire it, when you see it intellectually differently, has a totally different emotional experience. A good example of this is when you're a child and you have a doll and you love to play with the doll and you're having a really good time and then your older brother comes along and rips the head off. So you're very miserable about that. You have a certain experience to that. And then the doll eventually makes its way onto your shelf and you're around 12 years old and you look at the doll and you remember the experience and you see it through the haze of another 6 years of life and you're still mad at your brother about it, but it's a different experience seeing a different emotional reaction because you have a different intellectual attitude towards it. And then you're a mother and you see your own daughter playing with a doll and then you see your own son come and rip the head off and you again have a different experience, which is, you know, also different, distance out. This is one of the things that is another conclusion that I have, which is very simple, and that is no one can be omniscient because omniscience is knowing everything and knowledge is experience. And no matter what you know, you can't know what it's like, for example, to speak English and not speak English at the same time. Say you learned English at a certain point. You remember what it was like to not know English, but you only remember what it was like. It's not the experience, the emotional experience of not knowing it. And even if there was a mind that could see directly into your soul and know every little detail about you, it's still another mind that's enormous and very different seeing into you and experiencing you, and that's not the same experience as you being limited. And there's no way for that mind to limit itself and see exactly the way you are. That's a limitation on knowledge. There are millions of limitations on knowledge if we understand what knowledge is, and that's why that idea can't possibly be an accurate idea. It's logically impossible. So, and there are some things that are only improbable. There are some things that just logically you know can't possibly be true. Now, there may be, who knows, all kinds of divine minds. Let's hope that there's people out there more intelligent than we are. Let's just say that. But if there isn't, it doesn't matter because we live our lives the way we are. But I can say that if there are minds out there that are more intelligent, the last thing in the world they want is worship or fear from us. And they probably don't care what we think about them at all. Do you care? I mean, do you care what the ants in your backyard think about you? Let's just put it that way. No. You might come along one day and see that it's raining very hard and there's a bunch of water going into the anthill, right? And you might step up and you might take your heel and you might go like that and the water gets diverted and all the ants would come out of the hole and they would say, "That was wonderful, man. What's the meaning of life?" And you say, "Well, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. Let me tell you what the meaning of life is." And then you tell that meaning of life to that the ants, every single one of those ants are going to believe that for thousands of years to come. But that doesn't mean that you're accurate in your opinions. Because it really is that there are patterns, that there's reason, and that reason pattern, I think, is, you know, one of the things I realized when I was trying to decide, you know, because those of you who are familiar with Plato know that there was a big argument between beauty and truth. Beauty and truth. Which one do I want? Beauty or truth? But the fact is, if you don't, I realized I didn't have enough faith in truth to think it was beautiful. I thought emotionally it has to be beautiful, therefore my definition of beauty has got to direct me. And when I dropped that and I said, you know what, I'll bet it might actually be pretty interesting just to look at what the patterns actually are and go with it and drop the beauty, maybe it'll come out to be beautiful because that could very well be. And the patterns provide a much clearer idea. Now, one of my analogies for this is very simple. It is like a baseball game. You know, what would happen if, you know, everybody played baseball and nobody knew what the rules were? Right? Nobody knew what the rules were. Or there were 15, I mean, there were all the people who played baseball knew what they were, all the professionals, but all the rest of us who watch all the time had no idea what the rules were. And we were supposed to figure out what the rules of the game were. How many games would you have to watch as a very intent observer to come up with the rules? 2,000? 3,000, 4,000, something like that, right? Something like that. Now, that's my analogy for trying to figure out what the patterns are. We don't have the blueprint. We have a lot of people telling us what the blueprint is. But all those blueprints are, you know, ethical and rewards and punishment, and you can see directly that this can't be the accurate explanation of what the patterns are. So if you look at that, I think that we can see what the basic patterns of the baseball game are. Now, I'm not saying we can figure out what the infield fly rule is, right? Because it would probably take a million games to watch baseball and be an extremely good observer with a fantastic memory to be able to figure out what the infield fly rule was, for those of you who know baseball. I mean, that's just a very obscure little rule. You'd never be able to figure it out, almost, even though it would happen every once in a while, and that would be the one little mystery in your patterns. But anyway, that's my analogy for the patterns of life. And what I'm going to do to make this a little bit easier for questions is I'll pass out one page with all those definitions, qualities, and some of the other ideas I haven't had a chance to get to. It's just a one-page thing, and I'll say take your questions. And I can see a little bit later if there's any extra questions, because I've never tried to do that in an hour before. Yes. There's lots coming back. There's enough for everybody. Yes, ma'am.
Can you say more about the quality of emotion?
Quality of the emotion, sure.
What these are.
Yeah. Okay. So we have the definitions of the different emotions. I'll give you an example. So love. Love is something that we're all interested in. Now, why are we so interested in love? And also, why are we, so surprised when, a divorce happens and we find out that what we believed wasn't true about our partner and we immediately begin to hate them, like that second. We don't wait like 2 minutes or 3 minutes. That second that we have a different idea about our partner, we begin to hate them, right? Because they have just ruined our projected, life story, right? No one likes their projected life story ruined. And by the way, almost nobody likes their basic assumptions they've lived their whole life on, attacked either. And that's why philosophers are much less popular than almost any other group of people in the world. Some scientists compete with us when they do the same thing. But this is understandable. And I am not the Dionysius kind of guy that goes around and says, I'm looking for an honest man and looks, because if people don't want to understand, don't want to know something, that's just fine with me, because they're living their lives just fine, and they're quite happy. I think people are much happier than they actually accept. We're not all committing suicide all the time. People actually have more happiness than they think of, as I say. And there is a base of happiness that people don't pay attention to on a daily basis. And one of my other conclusions is that you can tell a lot about a society based on what they complain about. Everybody's always complaining about something. But if you're complaining, like in the late 80s, people started complaining about people calling them bad words on college campuses. And I thought, we're getting pretty civilized if that's what people are complaining about. Because, it used to be much worse things that people had to complain about. So the quality of our emotions. An example is love, okay? It's our attraction to what we see as beautiful. Now, beauty is what I call the quality in something that promises happiness. It's the quality that promises happiness. Now, what we really want in life, and almost never get, is we want true love. There's a lot of, fairy tales about it and everything. What is true love? True love is personal love. That is, the other person loves you for your personality. And that's why we're always, projecting one that isn't our real personality, because we think that one will be loved, whereas the real one isn't going to be loved so much. So we're always, this one's really lovable. How about this? This is who I am. And the fact is that in almost all relationships, there's a combination, in even the best of relationships, there's a combination of personal love and impersonal love. People love you for your personality, at least 80% of it or so. There are things that they would prefer changed, and this is, of course, why we're always trying to change other people. We want to change everybody around us into exactly the thing that we can love a lot, right? So we're always adjusting other people around us, at least in our own minds. And this is why it's pretty clear where rewards and punishments have come from, but that's another story. So true love is what we're really looking for, and we do get it sometimes. But some people get it from their parents. But a lot of that love is not personality driven. It's the fact that they wanted children and you are their child. And therefore, it's a little bit impersonal. It's you are their child, therefore they love you, because it was their desire and they found that having a child would be beautiful in and of itself and bring them a lot of happiness. They're absolutely right about that. Bring them a lot of unhappiness too, so they hate you a couple times, sometimes for some of the things you do. But, from a personal, impersonal point of view, love has different qualities. It's a very different quality. And everybody can recognize that personal love, that quality, that the motive behind it is, I like the way your mind works. I like the way you feel. In terms of as a person, as a personality, you're an entertaining personality to be around. It might be just because you're entertaining. They might also like it that you're rich. That's an impersonal part of it. They might like it that you're poor because they don't want to be with someone who's rich because they think that, you know, capitalism is a terrible thing and they want to be with poor people. So, you know, there's all kinds of reasons behind it, and everybody has their own reasons, but the basic pattern behind it is the same. You love somebody for their personality, and you love them for impersonal things as well, and that whole combination is all squashed together, and we feel the quality of the combination of impersonal and personal things, okay? And the easiest thing along the quality line to explain is the laughter, I think, the kinds of happiness that we have, because I think everybody can hear in laughter, passion, they can hear cruelty. Cruelty, I define as taking pleasure in another person's pain, okay? It's not that your mom was cruel to you, unless she really took pleasure in your pain. That happens. But she might have had strict rules for you. Oh, you're so cruel, Mom. You didn't let me go out until 5 o'clock in the morning when I was 12 years old. You know, that kind of thing. That's not cruelty. We use the word cruelty. That's in that way. But that's a vague and flippant use of it. Actual cruelty is taking pleasure in another person's pain. Now, when you think about it, this means you need to surround yourself with people in pain. Is that really that wise a thing to pursue? No, it's not. But we all do it a little bit. And why do we do it? Because we want to be more important than other people. I call it the importance of being important, and that's a whole other topic. But it's more crucial than almost any other generalized desire. Even the chickens have a pecking order. And the simians, all the animals have pecking orders because you want to be more important than the person. And when you're in great pain, you need to put other people around you in even greater pain so that you're the most important person left in the group. That's what motivates it. But the fact is that just makes us, make everybody around us worse off than they were before, ruining our lives as well as theirs. Right? Not a very intelligent pursuit, but you can understand it with that desire. Now, the importance of being important is one of those unfulfillable desires in some ways. But it's simply taken care of. Why do we feel that way? Because we have doubts about how important we are, right? And we have a lot of beliefs about making us important. And that's why any theory that tells you that you are the center of the universe and that there is some divine being or even a president, you know, you're friends with Bill, you know, how many people wanted to be friends with Bill Clinton when he was, because that means you're connected to somebody. How many people paid $1,000 to, political campaign fund to take 2 seconds to get a picture of them that they could then put on their office wall so that everybody thought that they were friends with the president? Marty and I know lots of people like that. So it is an attempt to be more important than you are, right? And now that basic desire is taken care of very simply, and then you can get rid of all the nonsense that goes with the alternatives. You must realize that you're indispensable to yourself. You are indispensable to yourself because only you make your own decisions, even when you decide that your whole goal in life is to obey somebody else and to submit to another discipline, to submit to a god, to submit to a guru, to submit to a political party, to submit to anything. All that giving up of your free will to other people is a submission on your own part, a giving away your free will, but it's your own desire. You can take it back anytime you want. You are the one that makes all those decisions, and you can take it back at any point, and therefore you are indispensable to your own decision-making process, your own pursuit of happiness. Unfortunately, that's the only thing you're indispensable to. Okay? And the way to make yourself feel important is to make yourself, to switch it to being valuable. You can be valuable to any institution, any other person, very simply by just giving more than you take away. Then you're valuable. It's that simple. And let me say that there's a generational shift here. You know, in my father's generation, the average CEO got his importance in society by being an extremely productive member of society, not by how much money he had. By bringing in an idea that was worth $50 million to his company and getting a salary of $250,000. Still 20 times what the workers made, yes, but it was $250,000. And now, because materialism is so successful, one of the other patterns that I've seen in human history is that when an idea is very successful, it's overused. It's overused. It's applied to all kinds of things that it doesn't really need to be applied to. And materialism is right now extremely successful because of all of our great technological advances, and everybody can see that this is a great way that we're all going to be a lot happier because, you know, who wants to, you know, not eat? Who wants to starve to death? There are all these things that people have suffered with for centuries that we're getting around. It's a big, big boon, and I'm not denigrating in any way, but it's applied to things it doesn't need to be applied to. And materialism is so successful that now it's measured how much money do you have. That's whether you're a productive member, an important member of society. Whereas, you know, before, it really was how generously do you give to all kinds of things. Now, I'm not saying that everybody was good in that generation and everybody's materialistic in this one, not at all. But there's a shift in the ideas of how we measure who's an important part of our society. You know, and Forbes running the rankings every year does not help. But this is, it's a very simple idea, very simple idea. There are a lot of patterns that you know, I could go into, but of course, there's not enough time. So that's a glimpse into a set of patterns about our personalities that we really can understand what we're up to, where we're going, and then the thing is, there is no goal. Everything is inherent. The patterns are all inherent. It's your choice what you do with it. And your personality, by the way, to get down to our personalities, and you'll see at the bottom there, I have a short clip from one of my essays about our personalities. But our personalities are really our greatest work of art. Everybody's an artist with their own personality. And you know, everybody really loves their own personality. They think it's really a wonderful creation. And it's very hard to shift another person's personality. You have to think, I could improve this way, or my imagination is in line with somebody else's ideas. You know, it's not that there are a lot of new ideas. There are some, but there aren't a lot of new ideas in the world. But there is a market share to the ideas. How much does a culture like this idea versus another idea? How many people are following this? How many people are pursuing their happiness in this way versus another way? That keeps shifting over time and lends its color to the overall culture of what's going on. But everybody loves their own personality, and they should. You shouldn't submit your personality to somebody else's. You know, it's like Gandhi said about India. India, badly run by Indians, is better than India well run by the British. And it really is a fundamental idea on an individual basis. If we do have free will, whether it was given to us or not, that's a whole other issue, but whether it was given to us or whether it's inherent in the way we are, in either case, we ought to be using it and exercising it. Because if it was given for a reason. I always think, you know, a good example of this to finish up with is the story of Abraham and Isaac. Well, story of Abraham and Isaac in the Bible. Jehovah picks out Abraham and says, you know, I'm going to start a new religion, and I want you to be in charge of it and everything like that. And I'm not like those other gods. I'm not like Baal and those other gods. I'm different. So you'll really like being, you know, my follower. 10 years go by. He gets the son, Isaac, you know, that he was aiming for. That's the reason Abraham went with the new God, is because he needed a son, and he didn't get one for a long time. Jehovah promised him. So he gets his son. The son is now 14, 15, 16, and Jehovah says, I want you to sacrifice your son to me. Now, the story goes on and says, you know, how Abraham, with a heavy heart and everything, goes up, and he makes the fire and lets the goat go and says, you know, actually, it has to be you, Isaac. And Isaac says, no. And he says, no, it has to be you. And he binds him, he puts him on, and he's about to light the fire, and Jehovah comes and says, just was testing you. You know, I see that you're going to be a good follower, and therefore you are my man. Let's get going. But I always think that this was a different test, that Jehovah was trying to see if Abraham noticed that he was just like Baal, because Baal wanted child sacrifice, and that was what they were rebelling against. And what Abraham should have said was, you know, Jehovah, if you're just like Baal, what difference does it make if I follow you or I follow Baal? I want my children, you know. And then Jehovah should have said, that's the follower that I want. That was the test. You passed the test by exercising your free will. And just to finish up, you know, on a biblical image, comes from Mark Twain. Mark Twain had the best analysis of the Adam and Eve story that I've ever read. And it really undercuts the whole fundamental idea. He said, Adam didn't want the apple because it was an apple, or because Eve suggested it to him. Adam wanted the apple because it was forbidden. The mistake lay in not forbidding him to eat the snake. And not only is that funny, but it tells you that an omniscient person who did not figure that one out when Mark Twain could figure it out, you know, if God did not want us to fall and do all the things, he should have just told them, don't eat the snake, none of this would ever happen. We'd all still be in paradise. Thank you very much.